This is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. And you're listening to Ecotopia, a weekly program exploring ecosystems, environmental, social, and technological. Each year in the North State, the Wild and Scenic Film Festival draws top filmmakers, celebrities, leading activists, social innovators, and well-known world adventurers to the Grass Valley, Nevada City area. The festival runs this weekend, opening with an art ceremony and showing of 3D films Thursday night, closing with an awards ceremony on Sunday. On the phone with us now is Samantha Hinrichs. She's the PR director of the Wild and Scenic Film Festival, which is also a project of CIRCLE, the South Yuba River Citizens League. Welcome, Samantha.
Thank you so much. It's my pleasure to be here.
We've got a lot to cover in a short time, so let's start with the days, dates, hours, and venues for the festival.
Okay, well, we started the festival a day early this year, which means it'll start this Thursday, which is January 10th. We have 3D films showing at the Del Oro Theater in downtown Grass Valley. And there's before that, there's also an art show reception over at the Center for the Arts in downtown Grass Valley. And then, for the rest of the weekend, there's events in both Grass Valley and downtown Nevada City, with the bulk of them in downtown Nevada City. So it's from January 10th through 13th. And the best thing is to look at the website, www.wildandscenicfilmfestival.org. And there's so much that's going on this weekend. It's quite incredible.
It seems like this festival has just grown and grown over the past few years. Can you give us some history on the festival? I mean, it's huge. I was looking at the venue maps. There's so much going on.
Well,
how did it get started? What festival is this for you?
Yeah, this is our 11th annual festival. It was started by a couple of the board members of CIRCLE 11 years ago. They felt that film was the perfect medium to tell the story of the drama of the environmental movement. After that, it grew into including films that were also about the outdoor, like everything you do outdoors.
Okay.
Then
yeah,
it's grown into the local food movement.
Wow.
And the other food, this kind of generally good food movement, because mm-hmm. as you know, and most of your listeners know, that we are part of an ecosystem. And so all of the different choices that we make are tied together. So the festival hired an incredible woman named Shauna Maziarz, who has been, well, this is the type of woman who for Thanksgiving she, you know, biked 50 miles a day or something, you know?
Yeah.
And so she really wanted to make the festival not just about the films inside. So now the festival there's more emphasis on the workshops, which are free to the public. They happen both Saturday and Sunday.
Okay.
There's events that go on outside on the streets. One of the streets is closed, Commercial Street, with live music. She is an educator, so there's a lot of children's events.
Nice.
So she's brought in the kids to watch these films for a special Thursday screening, and there's going to be an endangered species parade.
Oh, my gosh. That's what we do here in Chico.
Really?
Yeah. I coordinate with Steve the Endangered Species Fair, a huge pop-up parade. We had about 200 people last year.
Oh, my God. That's wonderful.
Yeah. I'm so excited.
We'll talk more about that.
Yeah. What day is it?
That's on Saturday.
On Saturday. Okay.
Yeah, Saturday at noon. It's right after the kids' session, so that everyone will meet up at the top of Broad, where Nevada Theater is.
Okay.
Put on their masks, get ready to go, and then come down, and then they meet up with, like, the evils of the world. And so there's cars and big oil and deforestation and all this. And then they
that
get swallowed by this big black cloth. And
oh, my gosh. I can't wait to see it.
I know. It's going to be great. So Shauna really grew the festival the last 2 years.
Okay.
I mean, she's done an amazing job because besides the outdoor world that she's in and the educational world, she's also been involved in the arts for a long time. So she's created a collaboration with Nevada County Arts. And so the art exhibit has also grown a lot, as you've noticed, in the last 2 years.
So what's the theme of this year's festival?
The theme is a climate of change, which I think is perfect.
Oh, interesting. It's ambiguous.
It's ambiguous, yeah, mm-hmm. because the thing is that the change makers, the people, you, me, the people who are listening, the people who attend this festival, we all know that we are going through incredible change right now. Mm-hmm. And so it's not just about climate change. It's about the interpersonal, interchange that we're going in. And then, of course, the huge global shifts that are happening in our environment and our water and our ecosystems.
Could you give us an overview of the films? How many? Where do the films come from, and how do they get into the festival?
Yeah, that's that. There's about 120 films this year.
Wow.
There's close to 30 that are premieres, either California premieres or world premieres.
Nice.
And for your if you haven't been, not all the films are feature length. Most of them are short length mm-hmm. films, so they play repeated times throughout the festival. The films start coming in from all over the world. Mostly they're made in the United States, and people submit them. The creative director starts looking at them, and then a committee looks through them and chooses the best films. And there's over, I think there was 380 films that were submitted this year.
Wow.
Yeah. And so they watch a lot of movies.
Yeah. Right.
And then they cull them down to the top. And if you, when you're on the website and you check out the films, you can look at them by genre, which is really interesting.
Nice.
There's about 8 different genres. And so if you're really interested in, you know, outdoor skiing and water issues, then you can focus your time at the festival on, say, just those two.
And you have a number of people coming to town. We'll be talking to two of them a little bit later in the program. Who are some of the notables who will be coming around and available to talk with festival goers?
Well, I think that's one of the remarkable things about Wild and Scenic. Someone was asking me, they're like, I didn't realize so many people came. And the thing is that it's almost like a conference because so many people in the environmental movement come that it's really amazing. You just walk around the street and meet these inspiring folks. So some of them are Anders Halvorsen. He's the author of An Entirely Synthetic Fish. Alex Hunold.
Oh my gosh.
He's from Sacramento, but he's a solo climber. He's one of those guys that just like climbs up giant cliffs by himself. There's a 16-year-old, Kelsey Cascadia Rose Juliana. What a name, right?
Right.
She works with climate justice, and she's speaking to the Wild and Scenic School program, and she's been doing a lot of activist work. Bill McKibben, won't be on the streets, but he'll be joining us by Skype.
Okay.
Yeah, he's come to the festival in the past, but this year he's not actually going to. He's going to stay at home for a little bit. He's been traveling.
Mm-hmm.
Garth Lenz, I don't know if you're familiar with him.
Uh-uh.
He's a photographer, and Garth's been doing this incredible photography work about oil industry in the Alberta oil sands.
Oh.
He's been documenting that since 2005.
We were curious, too. You're celebrating Aldo Leopold's birthday. What's that all about?
Well, Aldo Leopold is... he's sort of our spiritual
patron
grandfather
saint. Yeah.
of the festival. You know, we celebrated him last year with a special event, and so there's a lot of people who follow his work, and so there will be a reading of his masterpiece, and that'll be part of one of the events at the festival.
Mm-hmm. Great.
Yeah.
Oh, there's so much more to talk about. We are going to be talking to a couple of activists and filmmakers, so we need to
please
kind of
do.
Cut
they're,
this short.
They're,
yeah.
No, they're the people that people want to see. I'm just here to tell you to, you know, go to the website and come to Nevada City, and whatever you do, you'll have a wonderful time.
Great. Thank you very much, Samantha Hendricks, for being with us tonight. There are a range of passes available. It's a fairly complex schedule. You can come for part of the festival, the whole thing. Check that out on the website, www.wildandscenicfestival.org.
Yeah, it's wildandscenicfilmfestival.org.
Sorry,
and if you Google
right,
Wild and Scenic Film Festival, it comes right up.
Okay. Thank you so much for being with us tonight, and we'll be down there on Saturday. Looking forward to joining the festival.
Wonderful. See you then.
Good. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
River, the soul is a water wheel that no matter how it's facing, water pours through, turning, returning to the river. Even if you put your side or your back to the river, water still comes through. Shadow cannot ignore the sun that all day creates and moves it. The soul lives like a drop of mercury in the palm of a palsied man. Or say the soul is the moon, that every 30 nights has two, so empty in union that it disappears. The other 28 nights it endures in different states of separation.
This is Ecotopia on KZFR, and we're offering a preview of the Wild and Scenic Film Festival, which has become the Everything Ecological Festival. It's taking place this weekend in Nevada City and Grass Valley. One of the festival film titles that intrigued us is A Changing Delta, which tells the story about the restoration of a section of the Colorado River in Mexico and its effect on that community. Dr. Tom McMurray is president and CEO of Marine Ventures Foundation, which led this project and made the film. Tom will be at the festival showing the film twice on Saturday, and we'll give you the times and locations at the close of the interview. Welcome, Tom McMurray.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here tonight.
You're both a filmmaker and an activist, an environmentalist. Can you please tell us a little bit about your background and how it led you to founding Marine Ventures? Sorry.
Sure. My background is actually in science and sort of oceanography, and I was a research scientist, but I found the peer research not to be very fulfilling, and I ended up working in several Silicon Valley startups. Sort of the same area, and then ended up in the venture capital business, and that worked out really well. And I, about 10 years ago, I sort of retired from that business and decided I wanted to give back. So I tried to take all the skills I'd learned at those three previous sort of jobs and careers and start a foundation that would sort of focus on using Silicon Valley tactics to sort of combine technology with, like, compelling science and really motivated people to try to solve some of the great environmental problems.
We want to ask a little more about those various ventures and adventures, as we almost said. First, let's talk about A Changing Delta that you'll be showing this weekend. It's about where the Colorado now ends in a sink due to overallocation, drought, and so forth. Please tell us about that project. What were you accomplishing and who was involved?
We originally got involved as more technical consultants, looking at a sort of a technical mapping problem down there. We were invited by the Sonoran Institute, and we traveled to Yuma. We got on a small plane. We flew over the delta down to the Sea of Cortez, which is about 100 miles, with the Sonoran Institute and Lighthawk, and they sort of told us what they wanted to do. And we spent the next couple of days on the ground into the various sites. And as we started looking around, we sort of realized that it wasn't just trying to reconnect this river to the ocean, but But it was more about actually reconnecting the people to the river, and that the people wanted to do that. So we sort of stepped in and started helping them strategize about how really to communicate what they were trying to do to a broader audience, because they had struggled for years after essentially the government said the Delta was dead and there's no hope there, to raise both awareness and funds to continue the restoration work.
All this is echoing strongly with us because, of course, a great deal of concern in our area about the Sacramento River Delta, which has got a different set of problems, but equally needs restoration and help. So how did the people in the Colorado Delta, how did they take their message public, and which parts of that did you capture in your film?
They really spent their time talking to funders, government agencies in both the U.S. and Mexico of the need for additional water just to put back into the riverbed that would re-energize the riparian corridor and end up in the ocean and really promote, particularly for the shrimpers and some of the fishing industry. So they had a plan, and there was just a real sort of one-on-one approach by the Sonoran Institute and Pro Natura, which is their sort of counterpart in Mexico, to talk to agencies. And we sort of came and said, you guys got to tell more people than this, because the agencies don't really want to do it. And, you know, they have their own set of problems. And we said, why don't we try to document the work of all these different groups and get the story out? And so they said yes. We made the film, and we were honored to be, you know, selected to be one of the films in the Wild and Scenic Festival this year.
And what actually happened in the Delta itself? You've mentioned in some of your work a new U.S.-Mexico treaty about water flow and allocation and availability. Is there also work in the Delta itself in terms of the restoration?
Yeah, there has been some pilot work to actually go through, remove all the invasive species and plant back the native plants. And this is being done in several parts of the Delta, up near the border, halfway down over on a river called the Rio Hardy. And they're basically sort of building what I would say are sort of parks that demonstrate what the original river ecosystem looked like. And it becomes a focus point for bringing a lot of the school kids there, ecotourism, a lot of tourists go down there. So they basically started doing on a very small scale this work and trying to get the message out. And like I said, we felt like they needed to go bigger, and they actually had been working to support the treaty, which you can imagine the complications of
yes.
You know, Mexico and U.S. deciding how to reallocate water.
So is that going to happen? Will water flow again to this area, or what's the status now?
Yes, it was signed in San Diego a couple of months ago.
Nice.
And it is what I would call, amazingly, a win-win-win treaty, because it helps the Mexican farmers manage their water, their irrigation system, so they can store water in the U.S. It allows the U.S. to actually get some of the Mexican water of their allocation and use it when they need it. And then it also provides for up to 100,000 acre-feet of pulse flow to sort of reflush the Delta, and then up to 50,000 acre feet a year of sort of maintenance flows, which aren't what the original river was, but they're fairly substantial flows. So everyone's happy. It's one of those environmental things where it's just goodness all around, which is really exciting for us.
So how was the problem of over allocation solved? I want to get to the film and the process of the film, but I'm really curious about this, how the process has been here.
The overallocation, you know, that's a long story, and there's probably better people explain it. But the issue is there's a fixed amount of water that goes across the border into Mexico by a 1944 treaty.
Okay.
And it was sort of a very rigid thing, and both governments decided we can do this better, so it's a win-win.
Nice.
And we can help restore the river. So I mean, if they could do that in California, it would be a phenomenal
thing.
And it what needed to be done, but it took a lot of conversations, a lot of slow process of making people aware of what the consequences were. You know.
Right. Can we get back to the film for a second? Could you tell us a little bit about the process of making the film and how you were involved with that, who shot the movie, how you selected the images and interviews and so forth?
Sure. We, as I said, our original trip down there was started out with an aerial flight, so it's a vast, beautiful area. And once we sort of saw the scope of it in the different regions, we basically spent a couple of days. We met all the different groups, went to all the restoration sites, and you know, like any film, we basically worked out a list of all the places we wanted to cover, what we thought were the compelling messages. Probably the most important thing for us are working with our partners, because partners, when they open up, when they introduce us to people, allows us to get deeper and deeper very quickly into the community and really find out, you know, what's really going on. So we teamed up with Pro Natura and the Sonoran Institute and worked with them for months, sort of planning what we're going to do. They contributed an equal part of what they thought should be in the film as we suggested we wanted to shoot, and it was a fully collaborative process. And then it's a matter of, you know, 18 months, five or six trips, San Diego, Yuma, all over the Delta, different seasons, because, you know, the weather down there gets really hot in the summer, and there's some seasonality to it. And we just went to work and started shooting.
So did you shoot and then the script evolved out of that, or did you have a plan at the outset for everything that you wanted to cover in this order?
Yeah, that's a good question. We did not know when we started what we knew at the end, and like any film. I mean, and as we worked through and got deeper, we saw the relationship between the people in Yuma, Mexicali, the fishermen down in El Golfo, the Cocoa Pod tribe, you know, and then all the pieces started falling together and became much clearer of what was really going on. And what was really going on, these people just said, we're going to fix the Delta, and no one else cares, but we're going to go make it happen because it's our home. And they were always there. I mean, they were steadfast in their belief, and that was a story that we wanted to tell for a number of reasons.
Must have been inspiring for you to watch that happen.
It had its hours and days of frustration,
sure,
but looked at what could happen. And a couple of major U.S. foundations pulled out and said, we just don't believe this is going to happen. And I think the treaty passing is sort of a major milestone that will elicit change and how the Delta's managed, because everyone said this is a good thing, and now they have water, which is, you know, priceless down there.
Tom McMurray, we just have a couple of minutes left, and too short a time. I know with the Marine Ventures Foundation, you've been all over the globe. I wonder if you could mention that just briefly and tell us how our listeners can learn more about Marine Ventures.
We really sort of pick our projects and where we work by our partners, that they come to us most times with a compelling opportunity, and we bring certain skills and capabilities to them. We've worked in Mexico. We have another larger project we supported in the upper Colorado that happened this summer called Down the Colorado. We have a project in Western Australia, which is really an amazing story, called Coastal Walkabout, looking at the intersection, the conflict of a $20 billion a year oil and gas business with the traditional Aboriginal people's lives and their communities and in the marine ecosystems, and the role of citizen science in helping collect data to really drive the government to change its policies toward how they manage that.
Could you tell interested listeners where they could learn more about your work? These projects all sound important and really interesting.
Sure. Marineventures.org is our website. There's a number of descriptions of the different projects we're involved in, a little more about us, and links to all our partners and what they do. So it's a great place to start.
Great.
Dr. Tom McMurray, thank you very much for talking with us. And I think we want to give you a call again sometime and talk more on Ecotopia about your projects. But thank you for your amazing dedication to restore environments all over the world. And again, listeners, Tom will be at the Wild and Scenic Film Festival. The Changing Delta will be shown twice on Saturday. Saturday morning, program starting at 9 a.m. at Stone Hall, And then in the evening, it'll be at Veterans Hall, a program where the doors open about 6:30. The program starts at 7. Thank you very much for being with us.
No, thank you very much.
Good night. This is Ecotopia on KZFR, and tonight we are previewing the Wild and Scenic Film Festival taking place Thursday through Sunday in Nevada City and Grass Valley. Another one of the films that attracted our attention is titled Black Inside, Three Women's Voices, and it's based on the alarming fact that nearly 2 million people die around the world every year as a result of cooking over an open fire, breathing open fire smoke. With us on the phone now is Rodney Roscona. He's the film's director and producer. He's a cinematographer, photographer, and he will be showing and discussing the film twice, once Friday evening and again Saturday afternoon. Thank you very much for being with us, Rodney.
It's very, very gracious to give us this time. Thank you.
We were interested to learn that your film was commissioned by the Global Alliance for Clean Cookstoves, and that's an initiative led by the United Nations Foundation. Could you tell us a little bit about that initiative and how you became involved with it as a filmmaker and as an activist?
Well, I think it's really important at the very beginning, and I'm glad you started the intro with the Global Alliance. The Global Alliance for Clean Cookstoves was created, I believe it's a public private partnership that was led by the United Nations Foundation that was introduced by the at the Clinton Global Initiative in 2010 by U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. And since then, its main thrust, if you will, is to essentially save lives and improve livelihoods, empower women, combat climate change by creating thriving global markets for essentially clean and efficient household cooking solutions. It's amazing how many people really aren't really aware. And when people ask me what we've been working on this past year and I tell them what we've been doing, they just stand there looking at you sort of stunned that they've never heard of this before.
I hadn't either. I was surprised.
And even people who are in the industry. And I think therein is actually probably one of the, you know, the one of the core problems. I've had a career in advertising and I was aware of the issues around clean cookstoves before the commission with the United Nations Foundation. However, that was with one of the more prominent players, the Paradigm Project, who are one of many of the organizations who are providing clean cookstove solutions, rolling them out throughout East Africa and around the world. But, you know, they're really serious numbers. And I have to correct you, it's now changed as the new Lancet report that just came out from the Global Alliance that handed out the press release, and that will be available for those who are interested at the showing at Wild and Scenic Care at the end of the week. But it's no longer 2 million people. It's actually 4 million people.
My gosh.
So what does that mean? So what are the numbers? 4 million people die worldwide each year from exposure to cookstove smoke, and this is solid fuel, so that means wood, that means biomass products like animal dung that's mixed with straw that's dried in the sun. It could be charcoal. It could be even coal. 3 billion people in the year throughout the world, nearly half the world's population, still use polluting, inefficient cook stoves to cook their food each day. And it's a bit of a trap, really. So it makes it, can you imagine every meal you had to make required someone not just to crank up a wood fire that you normally do on holiday with your family and friends out by the lake, but that's every day in maybe a 3-foot by 3-foot square area with no ventilation and no lighting, and it's the woman's role inside the household, and it doesn't really necessarily mean it's in East Africa, or it's not just one hemisphere. This is really a global issue, and that's one of the reasons that the triptych was put together the way it was that it's too easy for people to see films and walk away and say, well, that's not really in my backyard, that's not really my life. But as more and more individuals and filmmakers and communicators, writers, activists, if you will, and bring messages to the table, it's a very, very small world, and we all have a role to play. So if you can imagine women every single day of their life, including young girls typically, get up in the morning, and I'm speaking probably specifically about northern Kenya, which is where Sarah's story was created, one of the three subjects in the film, Black Aside Through Women's Voices. Either her or her family or her children would go off sometimes multiple kilometers, many, many miles, whatever the distance, to in the search for wood to bring back to simply cook their meals. So that's on one level, it's arduous. For women, it's extremely dangerous. Rape, brutality, when they cross tribal lines, is more common than not. And it's not me saying it. It's like the Physicians for Human Rights. Rape or assault during firewood collection has been described almost commonplace. And so there are an awful lot of side issues that are beyond just the stove issue that affect predominantly women and young children inside the household. So, and you have to keep me on track because it's a huge subject. So, and I know you've got limited time, so whip me into the right lines where
well,
you want me to go.
How did you get involved in this project, and where did you go? I know the women's voices that you, stories you tell are from Africa, India, and Peru. Tell us about how you got to these places and how you got involved in the project.
Well, let's see, for probably more than many years I care to admit to, but over 3 decades worth, I've been an advertising photographer serving international advertising design community. And so about 13 years ago, I stumbled into Food for the Hungry, and they're a faith-based organization operating out of Phoenix, Arizona, that are in multiple countries around the world. And I became an advocate of theirs, and I, for the last 13 years, I had been sent around the world to cover not really nice issues, from AIDS, HIV, on down to famine, to water issues, sanitation. And through that experience, I've always tried to seek organizations to leverage what is essentially senior skills, mature skills, for the greater good. It sounds pretty hokey, but that's pretty much at the heart of it.
Sounds good.
And so from Food for the Hungry, I'm their chief photographer, and then the Paradigm Project, I'm their director of photography, and so I was involved with the cookstove issue for a year or two before, and they're a direct partner with the Alliance, as many other countries and corporations and organizations. And so I went to the field for the Paradigm Project to help build a library on this issue, and I think about a year ago, I started, I became aware of the Global Alliance, and I allowed them, not allowed them, but I wanted to play my part, and I made my still life photography available to them, which, you know, don't give me a piece of wood and a hammer because it would look really bad, but I'm actually very, very good with a camera. And so, consequently, about a year ago, almost to the date, I was requested to see if I'd be interested to be part of putting together a motion piece, and it grew. It started off being a very small PSA from one country, and because of my experience and relationships around the world, I was able to attract a team of about 70 individuals. That film, Black Inside, was made with about some 73 individuals worldwide.
Wow.
Who all, every one of them, just about stepped up and said, whatever is involved, we don't care about the money. We just want to be part of something
Amazing.
That's really important like this.
Amazing.
So consequently, consequently, to wrap that part up, I had very mature cinematic skill available to me from California into London. Serious producers. I had Goldcrest Post in London, Prime Focus in London. These are like the best you can get. Mm. And they all were just ecstatic to work on the film. I had L.A. County people, Scott Shepard, Chuck Lynx, all these individuals, my DP and camera people. At the heart of it, it's really trying to leverage our mature skills. My writer's the same age as me. My producer is, my DP. We all really wanted to put our creative skills to help create a new baseline on this particular subject. I guess we could have applied our skills towards malaria or HIV/AIDS, but you take advantage of times and what's presented to you. And so I put together, along with our writer, Russ Hahn, put together a series of concepts for the GACC, and they selected one of them. And we headed out to just off the Somali border and just south of Ethiopia's Ogaden, and photographed Sarah's story, which was the first backbone to the whole narrative. We spent about 10 days there, and then the whole team, I took this all up to on the border with Nepal to create Vandana. Vandana was showing another cross-section, an urban woman who was having, utilizing also fish and stoves because of the same issues. And then we took the team and we went to Peru and worked with various partners from the Global Alliance of Clean Cook Stoves. And just, I can't even tell you how remarkable of an experience, because none of us, even though we're all in advertising, all very seasoned and senior professionals, I probably, out of all of us, have been the only one that has spent the last 13 years in the field covering human condition issues. But it's traditionally always been very private, and now this gave me the opportunity to bring this whole team together. And now we're all poised at this point to move into, now that Black Inside, Three Women's Voices is complete, we're poised to move on to a 90-minute feature documentary just called Black Inside.
Interesting. I was about to ask, you must have miles of footage, hours of footage at this point. It must have been very difficult to select for the final short film, and it's interesting and exciting to hear that you're doing the feature-length version. Could you tell us a little bit about that process?
Yeah, right. What we recognized after the film came out of London about June or July of this year, out of post-production, I was invited down to Lima, Peru by GIZ Peru, another large player. They're part of the German government, kind of like our USAID, if you will. And so I went down there, and we had an exhibition, a symposium. I helped to open a symposium with still life photography that happened to do with energy for the rural poor. And that begat a very small tableside conversation where they said, you really, really need, you're poised at the right crossroads to get under a feature story on this. And here's the issue. When we started off, we said not many people know about this. And part of it is that when you do a documentary, it has a very limited audience. Mm-hmm. It's not, what makes a festival run. And I'm, even though I'm a seasoned photographer, I'm new in this whole festival aspect of things. Mm-hmm. Because our end client was the United Nations, and our film product is doing very well to help raise awareness. But it doesn't really have the reach that a public showing would, and that's when you come into the territory of feature documentaries. So we're now leveraging our ability and the skill. Everybody, the whole team, wants to be involved again, and so I'm surprised because the amount – I've just been so humbled by so many people who've given me so much of time and treasure – that it's just been absolutely phenomenal. And so now we're poised to go probably out to the desert again to focus on Africa to get under this 90-minute piece that will be called Black Inside, and we'll be seeking supporters. We're in conversation with various different funders. It's not really a lot of money, but because of the skill set we have and the relationships we have, I have the ability of being in the field and really spending time to really broaden this this lack of awareness, again, from a creative point of view. And I see myself as a creative advocate in support of the Global Alliance and what they're doing. Mm-hmm. It's a very small industry, and that really kind of has to change. It's big, getting bigger and bigger. And as a communicator, I want to play my role to make it, give them access to serious image capability, and that's what my whole team are interested in doing because it's so serious.
I want to change gears only slightly and rave about the photos that are the still photos on your website. You've got portfolios on healthcare, American Life, Halfway Houses, Pink London, and some of the other issues that you've mentioned. Could you tell us just a little bit about your work as a still photographer, and how does a portfolio or an exhibition of stills differ from putting together moving images for a 90-minute feature?
Well, I'll try to encapsulate the larger part, without being as long-winded as I have a propensity being, is that goes back to where I started. I work very, very, very well with the human condition. It's just something I'm very predisposed to. I'm in Los Angeles at the moment on a week-long project for a United States corporation that is dealing with the human condition. And that's been probably borne out and bred by an awful lot of time in really, really rough areas throughout Rwanda, Uganda, the Congo, Mozambique, Ethiopia, India, Latin America, Southeast Asia. I've spent an awful lot of time in the field as a single individual sent out to cover, almost like from a journalistic standpoint, it's just I don't work for a newspaper. Mm-hmm. So I'm not a war or a conflict photographer, but I'm at times in conflict situations, such as last September I was in Dadaab on the border with Somalia covering the famine and distribution and relief work for Food for the Hungry. So I find myself in these situations. And so the Pink Door photographs was a result of being sent down to Haiti at a time when the images coming out of there were very, very difficult. It was unsavory, and with all due respect, it was truckloads of unfortunate people who had met their demise. And I went down probably really oddly. I was probably not the only advertising guy that would have been in the environment to create conceptual photography. Before that, it was predominantly you'd have journalists and news reporters down there doing their work. So we were invited down by Medair out of Switzerland, and we went to Jack Mel instead of Port-au-Prince. It was a little quiet, but quieter. But the Paradigm Project and Medair facilitated bringing me and my DP, Scott Shepherd, down to Jack Mel. And I really was trying to figure out a way to raise attention, because interest had already started waning very quickly after the earthquake, because the attention in the world is off to the next issue or next tragedy. Yeah. So we got under doing a series of very dignified portraits, and that's kind of a landmark and a trademark of mine. I work with women a lot. I work with families a lot. Uh-huh. This has nothing really to do with my advertising work, but it has influenced the way I see uh-huh. and the way I work with individuals, and that plays well with when you said healthcare. Uh-huh. How am I used in industry? It's a few years ago, I was hired by a very well-known pharmaceutical to work on an AIDS-HIV package. So that took logistical skills around the world to create serious images of that very leading problem. And so whatever you see on my website has been the result and the benefit and the blessing of working for these NGOs who've trusted me. Again, it has to be the Paradigm Project. It has to be Food for the Hungry. It has to be, now in this instance, aside from my commercial work, probably the most important work I do is in the field, where at 56 years old, I'm able to leverage 30-some years' worth of advertising skill conceptually to help clients. But in the same instance, I've got and now my team of filmmakers, we have the team, as we call ourselves, the Black Inside team. We're looking to take on this very serious issue because I have a very basic core belief, and that's that everybody needs to play their part. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't have to be across the world like I'm doing. It can be inside your own household. It can be down the street. It can be your neighbor. It's always a very emotional process for me to talk about working with people who are really no different than you and me. They're just having a really tough time in life right now.
Right.
They may be vulnerable. I don't really like to use the word poverty or who are poor. So me as an individual, I've spent an awful lot of personal time with the Turkana tribes people, the Rendillis, the Gabra. In fact, I'm a Gabra elder. I was made a Gabra elder because of my work in that village just off the Somali border in northern Kenya. And these are long, ongoing relationships, and I can't tell you how many people I've got to just want to sign up to come to the field with me. So my work, I think, probably as a mature image maker, and I really believe mature communicators, and I don't mean necessarily an iPhone camera. I'm talking about serious photojournalists like Ron Haviv from Seven, David Burnett. These are serious journalists that you send to the field because of their skill and their perception for issues that we want to know about. In America, we have this sort of concept that just because you have a camera, then all of a sudden you're elevated to this vast ability. You have this vast ability to communicate serious subjects, and maybe it's an age thing. I would like to feel that experience has value. And when you start dealing with these serious issues.
Listeners, Rodney has an incredible body of work. He's director and producer of the film called Black Insides, Free Women's Voices. He'll be in Nevada City on Saturday, going to be showing the film Friday evening at 6 o'clock, Saturday at 1 o'clock in Vets Hall. You can also learn much more at the website for the film and also at Rodney's website, which I would strongly encourage you to visit, www.roscona.com. I'm sorry, our time is short, Rodney. We really want to thank you for being with us. We're looking forward to seeing your film on Saturday, and we appreciate your taking time to be with us.
You know, thank you for the opportunity. One clarification, we have three showings. We're two showings on Saturday, showings on Saturday. And the whole reason is it's not about doing a film. This is serious individuals dealing with a serious subject. And we hope to enlighten people and maybe help them get up out of their chair and play their part as well. Thank you for your time. I greatly appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
This has been KZFR on Chico. Sorry that we didn't have time to spend more time with both of our interviewees tonight, but they'll both be in Nevada City over the weekend. Check out the website for the Wild and Scenic Film Festival. It's wildandscenicfilmfestival, all one word, .org. Next week on Ecotopia, we'll be talking with Derek Hoff, who's written a book called The State and the Stork. It's about the politics of population growth in the U.S. And 2 weeks from now, we'll be focusing on another brilliant local festival, that of the Snow Goose, which comes up later in the month here in the North State.
And on January 26th, we'll have a puppet-making workshop for our procession of the species here in Chico. It will be Saturday, January 26th, from noon to 5. Contact me, Susan, at turkeytailfarm.net to learn more. Check us out on Facebook at Procession of the Species, Chico, California. Ecotopia is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR members and by EcoCab, Chico's green alternative taxi service. EcoCab provides safe, reliable transportation 24 hours a day in a new fuel-efficient Toyota Prius. Protect the planet and get to where you need to be with EcoCab, the cab that cares. Call 591-3186. And by String Bead, Chico's home for bread lovers, bead lovers, and bread lovers, and jewelers of all kinds. String Bead has everything to do with beads and a fully equipped workshop where you can learn the art of jewelry and bead making. Classes, workshops, and parties available in the Almond Orchard Plaza at 2201 Pillsbury Road. More information by calling 894-2323 and at stringbead.com.
We hope you'll stay tuned to KZFR Chico. Coming up at 7 o'clock, Aunt Susan and Uncle Steve will be hanging around to do the Storyteller with a themed show on dreams and maybe a little bit about nightmares. And then at 7:30, host Senior Felipe serves up East L.A. Cholo, Soul, R&B, Oldies, Blues, Doo-wop, Latin, Folk, and Gospel, plus social commentary and interviews with interesting members of the community. L.A. Sounds takes you back home to the roots where it all began. Back on the block, come on home with Senior Felipe. Thank you for listening to Ecotopia. I'm Stephen Schutte.
I'm Susan Schutte. Contact us at ecotopiakzfr@gmail.com or visit our website, ecotopiakzfr.net. You can also become our friends on Facebook and receive advance notice of upcoming shows.
You're listening to FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond.
The king and the queen said to the prince, "It's time you said goodnight. Get under the covers and say your prayers and we'll turn out the light." The prince, he was not tired at all. He didn't know how to sleep. "How shall I start my dreams tonight by counting silly sheep?" The king said, "I shall tell you a tale that you will not believe. When I was a lad, I too believed I could not go to sleep. A leprechaun appeared one day and told me what to do. So I will tell you now, my son, perhaps this will help you. Oh, you jump on the bed, you stand on your head, you whistle a tune to the man in the moon. He whistles a tune right back to you, and everyone says goodnight." Have their tea, and when an hour had gone by, they tiptoed back to see. They opened the door and peeked inside, and what do you think they saw? The prince was dancing with the moon's new shadow on the wall. So a party was declared that night with dancing tune and song. The moon joined in until the morning brought the sun along. By then the prince was fast asleep, he had the silliest dream. He dreamt his father told him, "This is how you fall asleep. Oh, you jump on the bed, you stand on your head, you whistle a tune to the man in the moon, and he whistles a tune right back to you, and everyone says goodnight. Oh, you jump on the bed, you stand on your head, you whistle a tune to the man in the moon, and he whistles a tune right back to you, and everyone says goodnight."
You're listening to The Storyteller on KZFR Community Radio Chico. The Storyteller is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR members and by CORE, Community Options for Resources and Education, a personalized Learning California charter school accredited by the Western Association of Schools and Colleges. CORE offers a unique blended classroom and non-classroom public education model based on the needs and interests of each individual student. Information is available on the web at CORETCA, that's CORETCA.org, or by calling 894-3952. On the Storyteller tonight, Grandma Susan and Grandpa Steve will be doing some stories about dreaming and falling asleep.
We were laughing in the new sun. We were sailing on the sea. We were dancing in the west wind. Now the world is ready for your dreams. Now the world is ready for your dreams. We were walking on the mountain.